Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Dr. Michelle Cohen, and welcome everybody to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, as you always are here on LATalkRadio.com, Channel 1, every Tuesday, about 12 noon here, Pacific Standard Time, and actually wherever you are listening from around the world. We are live on the WWW here, and as always, I have an amazing guest. Today, you're going to become inspired by hearing the amazing story of Edmund Hagem. He's an American financier and philanthropist who actually rose from extremely difficult childhood circumstances in order to achieve professional success and personal fulfillment. And I'm pretty sure that you're going to be learning a lot of wonderful suggestions and teachings from Ed about how to overcome any negative circumstances that you may have or are experiencing in your life in order to become successful, abundant, and happier in your own lives. And that's what we're all about here on the couch. And I'm going to be talking to Ed Hagem about his latest best-selling book. It's called On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. It is a best-selling book. Well, it is, it's a novel. It's great. And it's also his memoir. So let me just give you a little, see, there's so much information to tell you about Ed, but I'll just try to make it as short as I can because he has so many accolades here. But Ed Hagem is a seasoned Wall Street executive. He has more than 50 years of investment experience. He has held senior management positions with the capital group E.F. Hutton and Lehman Brothers before becoming chairman and CEO of Furman Sites. Ed has also been the chairman and CEO of ING Itis Group and also ING Furman Sites Asset Management, also of MLH Capital, and he's now chairman of High Vista Strategies, which, by the way, is a Boston-based money management company. So I just want to share with you another brief background. And then I want him to take over because he is the master and he'll be sharing with you his story. Just kind of briefly here, some really interesting facts. In 2008, after 20 years as a trustee of the University of Rochester, Ed Hagem began an 8-year tenure as chairman of the university's board of trustees. And he gave the school a most generous $30 million. Yes, $30 million, the largest single donation in its history to support scholarships and endow the Edmund A. Hagem Foundation. And it's the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. So through the Hagem Family Foundation, he's made generous donations to organizations that promote education, healthcare, the arts, culture, and conservation. And I can go on, like I said, about Ed's achievements. But, you know, that would take up the whole hour. So I want to bring you up.
They don't have to talk to be good.
Thank you so much for coming on the couch here with me today. This will be an amazing, amazing interview. So, you know, let's talk about your book and your story. And just to sort of start off here, again, thank you so much for joining us. So my listeners always tell me that they want to hear about, you know, the backgrounds and the childhoods and hurdles that a lot of my successful guests have had to overcome. So in reading your book, On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom, I was really fascinated. And I was also kind of sad to read about the difficult experiences that you had to endure, you know, while growing up. So can you talk about those experiences and how they contributed to building your resiliency to become your successful person that you are today?
It is an odyssey of sorts. But, Michelle, the key, there's two parts to that. You said, you know, tell about the odyssey. You also said, you know, how did that affect your life? And
right.
One of the things that's important about writing a book like this is you find out what your background does for you as an adult.
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to break this thing too easily, but, you know, if you spend 15 to 20 places when you're before you're 18 years old, you develop a capability of adaptability.
Yes.
And resilience and right. perseverance. And these things are some of they're gifts. And unfortunately, they come from a rather difficult childhood. And I could describe it if you'd like. Yeah. I could do it in, you know, in very short fashion or give you the little longer version if you'd like, whichever you'd like.
Well, whatever you'd like. I mean,
how
about the medium version? How's that?
My father had a very unusual background. He lost all his money in 1929, married my mother on a trip across country. I was the only happiness in their life, according to them, born in 1936. You can't calculate. It's like when you ask a four-year-old how old he is, he says he's 4 3/4. I'm 84 and 3/4.
You're so funny.
Anyway, so there was a depression. Things were difficult. He was 15 years older than she was. He really resembled Abraham in Leo Neuris's book, The Hajj.
Oh.
He was not an easy man to deal with, and she was
yes.
a young girl.
Sure.
And I was born, and he had trouble finding a job and blah, blah. At 1939, this 24-year-old mother decided to get divorced, which was shocking.
It is.
And we got divorced in L.A. I was living in L.A. In hotel rooms and motel rooms around L.A.
Oh, yeah.
And so she Dad didn't show up at the proceedings, so she got custody, and he got $5 a week, alimony and child support and visiting rights on Sunday. So she picked me up and took me back to St. Louis, where her family was. She was not welcome because they had
goodness.
Five other children, and having a 24-year-old divorced person in 1939 was not good. The old man decided he couldn't live without me, so he drove to St. Louis, picked me up, and instead of taking me to a movie, took me back to Los Angeles. He essentially kidnapped me. And he told me
never
see my mother again. I describe it as follows. Dad was feeling and not thinking.
Yes.
Mom was thinking and not feeling. Because she felt at the time that basically, that given she got back to her parents' house, they didn't really want her or me. And she felt that I might do better with my father. So she left. She didn't have any resources. So she couldn't really, you know, do anything. She couldn't hire anybody. She had no money, so on. So, and for a couple of years, Dad and I lived together. He was a merchant marine aboard a ship. Mm. So I spent some time with the neighbors. I mean, the 2 years we spent together, half of it was spent with the neighbor lady. Half the time he spent at sea. When the war started, he was either drafted or volunteered to become an officer in the Merchant Marines. He was 41 years old, a single child, so the question whether he volunteered or he was drafted. Anyway, that started my EJIRA, five Catholic foster homes. After the war, he came back to the East Coast rather than the West Coast, so I flew across country. We ended up in the YMCA on 34th Street for a couple months, and then in Coney Island in a hotel room. He couldn't find land-based work. So at the last minute, in fact, I spent part of the summer at age 11 alone in Coney Island because he had to go to sea.
And then
I ended up in two Jewish orphanages, one in Far Rockaway and the second one in Yonkers. So in a sense, you know, I became very independent. I obviously, you know, resilience is a muscle. When you go to five different schools, it's a rites of passage each time.
You
find out who you can beat up and who can beat you up. You know,
that's
in the
right.
schoolyard. That's
exactly.
the ball game. So you develop an adaptability, which is, you know, and I always tell kids with bad backgrounds that in many respects you're blessed because, you know, these kinds of things early build, you know, strengths that you can't get any other way.
Yes.
And I tell my comfortable friends, which most of which are comfortable now, what do you do with our kids? I say, well, you send them to Outward Bound, or you send them to National Leadership School. Or you make them a little uncomfortable, make them work, and so forth. So anyways, that was the background. Dad and I, sort of had a mutual peaceable coexistence.
Yes.
And the big turning point was I got a scholarship to go to college, and that was the big breakthrough. Went to the second orphanage had an excellent high school where most of the kids went to college, and I applied to three colleges and got into all of them, and I got a naval NROTC scholarship, and that changed my life. That was I could still see the letter.
Yes.
Because the letter started out with typical government fashion. It said, you have not been selected as a candidate at the NRTC. Then it went through three or four paragraphs.
Right.
Then the final paragraph said, you've been selected as an alternate, and your alternate number is high enough that you will be selected.
Oh, good. Oh, my God. It's rather confusing and a little disheartening, the first sentence, right?
So, but the bottom line is that if people ask me, how did you get out? The real key, and this came from the book basically, is that if you're never a victim,
right.
If you're never a victim, you can always then focus on what's next.
Yes.
That makes the job a little easier. If you use your energy, and I know your show probably spends a lot of time talking about energy. Use your energy on being a victim, that you don't have the strength to go forward, because going forward is tough. Looking ahead is hard.
Absolutely.
So if you don't have a victim, and then your disadvantages as a child, a lot of them, not all of them, become advantages. Certain disadvantages hang on, like anger. Hung on all my life. I mean, I still occasionally get annoyed at things that I shouldn't get annoyed at. But a lot of the disadvantages that I described become very, very strong advantages. They become first of all, nothing is terrible anymore.
There you go.
You've been through and then you become a chemical engineer at college. You get the worst possible education. You've done it all.
That's exactly right. Yeah, but also there's something to do with who you are, and I don't mean to get airy fairy or anything, but I mean in your soul, and that's who you are, as a strong person who overcame so much in your life, and so it just blows me away to be a little transparent here that, you know, you were telling your story and I was recalling that my grandmother did the same thing by divorcing my grandfather back in 1931. And that was unheard of.
That was unbelievable. Yeah.
So my mom grew up in foster homes and really, you know, shared a lot of similar, you know, ups and downs, and she was a very strong woman. So, but your story is just
Michelle, that's what's so wonderful about this book. Just what you just said, everybody shares their experience with me, and I'm learning so much about so many people. I mean, people stop me and they say, you know, when I was a child, my grandmother divorced my, and it was just, you know, we relate immediately, and it's so much fun.
Isn't that fun? I mean, it is. It just connects everybody. And what I love about your book, On the Road Less Traveled, is that a lot of people can learn so much also from your experiences, even if they can't identify, they can say, oh, my God, and say, my life is a piece of cake compared to Ed's, you know, so I maybe I can take some of his suggestions and how he overcame issues and apply it to my life too, which is nothing compared to what Ed had to deal with. So it's just amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. What a fascinating story.
Well, the books are written better than I just described it. The foster homes, for example, there was a terrible one at the beginning. I mean, the guy was awful. And the last one was wonderful. Mrs. Robb. And in the book, there's a letter from Mrs. Robb describing me. And she was a wonderful lady. And that's one of the things I took away, that woman showed me what a real family was like. And I put that away in my little back of my head. And I said, someday, you know, that's what that my life is going to be like. And that was wonderful. Right. So, you know, that's why I think, and I had to go back. My father saved every letter that I wrote to him when he died. It was in a suitcase.
Wow.
And I saved every letter he wrote to me. Yes. So I had to go back and research all this because, you know, the facts and what you remember are two different things.
They really are. We can destroy it in our memories because they were so painful.
The first time I wrote my background, this is what I just described in a few minutes now. I've done it enough times it doesn't bother me, but I couldn't do it. My daughter had to go back and do it. She actually wrote the first description of my childhood because I just couldn't handle it because it brought back memories.
It's
when I was
really
18,
tough.
I did something that psychologists would hate. At 18, I decided that I was going to bury my background and never talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then everybody said, that's crazy. Yeah. I buried it because there I didn't have to deal with it then. When
there
I went to college, I didn't have to deal with it. And when I was 55 years later, when my wife and the University of Rochester said, we got to know more about you, I opened up. I was 75 years old. And I said, okay, you guys want to know? My wife knew most of the story.
Yeah.
Kids knew half of it.
Sure.
But nobody knew it all. And so it's a very interesting sort of, you know, experience doing it that way. But burying it allowed me not to deal with it.
Well,
and I became a new person. And so I talked to kids. A lot of the kids, they let it hang out. But I mean, I didn't let it hang out. I said,
no,
not going to tell anybody.
Oh, I think, you know what? That is I think, a healthier coping mechanism to deal with trauma sometimes. Because, I mean, when we do bury it and we just go, okay, that was the past, or it's just down there in the subconscious, and I'm going to focus on my journey, you know, and that is a coping mechanism sometimes, which can really help us succeed.
Yeah. A little bit of denial doesn't hurt.
There you go. It does. It absolutely. And so, you know, but sometimes it is when we're ready, it is healthy, you know, to sort of take a look and bring it up. And I really appreciate the way that you didn't let your children know as much. And, you know, your wife knew most. But I mean, it is lovely to be able to finally, you know, open up with it, but it is a good coping mechanism to just sort of shove it down and focus on with your life.
It was, you know, it's tough enough. You know, why do you have to spend your entire 4 years of college explaining stuff that you don't want to explain? You know,
exactly.
And by the way, the task itself is hard enough going forward. So
right,
you put the stuff in the back there because you couldn't relate to anybody. I probably was the only orphan.
Yeah,
and the only person in the freshman class, you know, and I didn't have mine wasn't a simple orphanage. I had, my mother supposedly died when I was three, and my father was a merchant marine. So it was too hard to explain, you know.
Exactly.
Interesting.
It is fascinating, you know, and especially back then, things that, you know, just weren't kosher,
Also, in those days, you know, if you got help, it was a bad idea.
That's right.
Then you weren't, you know, those days, the people that got help, it wasn't such a good thing.
You were crazy back then.
I was going to say that. But you said it. No, if you got help, you were crazy.
Yes.
And therefore, I never got help until, you know, when my father died, I finally decided I would go and get help. And I described that in the book.
Wow. And I it's a beautiful story. And by the way, in case you all just tuned in, you're on the couch here with Dr. Michelle, and I'm talking to Ed Hageum. He's the author of an amazing book. It's a bestseller, and it's called On the Road, Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. And we're just sharing his background story. By the way, in case you just missed it, you can also listen and download the show if you'd like. Just go back to our archives here on LA Talk Radio and pull up On the Couch with Dr. Michelle. And the show will be in the archives to listen to immediately when we get off the air. All right. So that's the best way to do it. Also, you know, I'll give you more information at the end as to how you can pull up the show and listen. But you're here with us right now, hopefully. And I want to talk more, Ed, about you now and your company, and, you know, just tell me what's going on in your mind about what you think made your company stand out.
Well, you know, it goes back to college. I think
what
I tell young people is try to find your passion. Now, passion is an overused word.
Sure.
It's a combination of interests, talents, and passion. Somewhere in my junior year when I was taking organic and physical chemistry, I decided the University of Rochester was not having enough fun, so I decided to start a humor magazine.
And okay.
I put 30 people together, the president, the provost, the head librarian, they all hated it. But I put these 30 people together, and in doing that, I found that there was another passion. It wasn't necessarily math and science.
Mm.
And it was organization, managing people, and I found something that really excited me. I didn't know it then. I found it out later on in my business career, is helping people to do better than they think they can, to exceed their own expectations, really turned me on. It excited me.
Yes.
And that really sort of was, I've used that in my business career. People walk into my office, or I've managed a number of different companies and had fairly good success, and people really feel that I'm interested in them, and I'm interested in them not only helping the company, but even helping themselves. That's key. And then I added later on in my career the concept which Ronald Reagan laid bare. You know, you can do almost anything.
Yes.
If you don't worry about who gets the credit. So you combine those two things, and people feel. Then you got to obviously walk the walk. I mean, I was the CEO for a company for 20 years, and in the 20-year period, I paid myself the most money only in one of those 20 years.
Oh my goodness!
So that's walking the walk. I mean, people did better than I did, so you know they get paid more. So and in the Humor magazine, I found out something else too. Obviously, we had to generate some money, so I had to go out and sell advertising. And so I hit the road. And by the way, if you sell advertising, you sell something.
Yes.
To people you never met before.
Right.
And something that doesn't exist yet, you're in pretty good shape for life.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, sure.
That exactly what I did. I sold advertising in a magazine that had never been published before.
Yes.
So, and I learned later on that this was a talent that, you know, helped me do things. Because when you're starting something new in a business, it doesn't exist. But you have to sell it to the constituency that exists when they're there. In other words, you'll take a project in to your partners or your boss and so forth. And you'll say, this is what I want to do. Well, it doesn't really exist yet. And you've got to be able to sell it. So those are the things that made, I think, our company different.
Sure.
I did get what I consider very good experience. I had a capability to go to a place, again, go to a place, work there.
Right.
And as long as things were good, you know, and things they were doing the right things, I'd be willing to stay. But as soon as they started doing things that I disagreed with, I would leave. E.F. Hutton, which is a wonderful firm, hired me to run a business. I ran the business well for 3 years. The CEO and I were very close friends. Wives were close friends. Mm. And I said, we'll take this business and we'll merge it with one of the other businesses. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. I want you to become the head guy in the main business. I said, no, the main business is run by a very important guy. He knows that business. I don't know it. And he wouldn't do it. So I left and went to another firm.
Yes.
And the same thing, I think, when I had my own firm for better than 20 years, is basically I let people, you know, strike out on things they believed in. Because I found that that's the one way to run businesses.
Oh, yes.
Someone's a zealot, you know, and he really believes.
Right, exactly.
His passions, you know, you let him do it, or her do it in this case. The firm ran really well. Over a 20-year period, we grew it from 70 employees to 800.
Oh,
and we sold it to Xerox. We bought it back, and then we sold it to a big Dutch company. So everybody who worked for me sort of had a good time. Made a little bit of money and had some fun. So it was a good experience, and I enjoyed it because I was never really the CEO. I was a guy.
Yes.
I was sort of the orchestra leader. I was trying to get people to do what they wanted to do, and they knew if they did well, I would pay attention to it, and I'd give them the credit. Mm. So that's a long answer to it, but it's a very complicated question because it took in, you know, a whole learning experience. The first 20 years of my business experience was all learning. Then when I was 47 years old, I got my own company. I became the CEO, and I ran it for 20 years, which was fun.
Then,
as you described, I was ready to run a hedge fund for a period of time. And along came the University of Rochester, and I said, well, if I'm going to do this, I've got to close down my business activities, and I've got to do this only because it's 30,000 people, you know, $3-4 billion operation.
Sure.
You know, you have to spend time on it. And I came to the conclusion, this early in life too, I always say failure early in life is a gift. And I failed very early. I had a company which I was running, and I tried to do too many things at the same time. I tried to market, manage the people, manage the portfolio. That didn't work. And so when I took over the University of Rochester, this is something I really want to do. I've got to give up my business. And I think that's the case with, there's a balance that I always tell people. It's self, and you know this better than I do.
Yeah.
It's family. It's work, and then it's community, and community is giving back. And you can't do, you know, balance is part of expression BS. You can't ever be in balance. You're always emphasizing your work or your family or yourself or your community. In this case, I decided I was late enough in life. I'd made enough money, and I really wanted to spend time in something where I could give back. And the university is a wonderful place to give back. I highly recommend it to anyone.
Because that's beautiful.
You can, Michelle, you can exercise any passion you want, whether it's wrestling or quantum physics, you can get behind it. You know?
Right. No, it's really true. And you know, I know that you've listened to the shows in the past, so you're aware of some of those things that we talk about. And, but you are, as we call it, a master manifester, and also your soul, a very driven one. to create the empires that you have. And also, you know, the kindness and giving. You're such a generous person as well, which is such an important key in life, I think.
And Michelle, it's also, always get back more than you give.
Is that the truth? That's beautiful.
No, you take one of my scholarship students is 5 foot high, weighs 100 pounds. she is an optical engineering major and a concert pianist and a concert violinist. And when she got her PhD, she stood up and said, "If it wasn't for you, Mr. Hager, I wouldn't be here." That paid back anything I've ever done in my life.
Ah, that is just
that's what you get back.
It's true.
All right.
No, yeah, exactly. So, and I just love it that you gave to your alma mater. That's just so beautiful. And I'll so
it was my first real home. You know,
yes.
So I owe that to them, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's what we do. We go back to those wonderful experiences is what they taught us. So in those lessons, I in reading your book, you talk about being deliberate in everything we do. Make sure every mission has a well-defined rule. And nothing can be accomplished without a well-motivated team. And just that's exactly what you were talking about. And that's how you motivate people. Your style is one of the most successful ways of being a manager and CEO of a company, the way that you really help people and encourage them and delegate and all that. So that's beautiful. I also wanted to get a little, as we say, shout out to the person that you mentioned in your book, who you're so grateful towards, who helped you get to where you are, Steve. So you can sure share that information as well.
You mean P1?
Yeah, P1.
Partner one.
There he is.
The four P's, find your passions, find your principles, find your partners, and find your friends. The most important partner is find someone to love. Find someone to share your life with. Someone who you can support, who will support you, and you know, who knows you and tells you to stand up straight and tells you when your pants don't fit and the whole business. And you know, we've been married for 55 years. And
goodness.
I think Billy Graham said the best marriage is one of forgivers, and we've been forgivers. But Barbara's been there all the way through. You know, she just adds to everything. Anything we've ever done, I always check with her. She's sensible. We're very different. You know, I'm scientific. She's artistic. You know, I'm an athlete. She wasn't, although she plays golf now, so it's fine.
Oh, there you go.
But we like to dance, and there's a few things we have in common. We kid about that. But Barbara, the most important thing you can get in today's, you know, with Bill Gates divorcing his wife, I sort of it really sets me back, because he was one of my heroes, you know.
Yes.
He's done it all, you know, and it's kind of sad. And I really believe in the fact that, you know, if you work with your marriage and you find someone and I'm not saying marriage is just a relationship, it really is very special. So she's been there all the way, and we have three children and eight grandchildren, seven grandsons. So, you know, that's a joy. I can tell you what my 7-year-old said last week. You know,
yes. What did he say? I'd love to hear this.
Oh, you want to hear? This is a great story.
Yeah.
Okay. They bought a little house up in Bedford, New York, and his father decorated his room, the bedspread and the carpet and the wallpaper all matched. And he said,
beautiful.
He said, "What do you think, Oscar?" Oscar says, "I don't like it."
Oh.
I said, "Why don't you like it? The bedspread matches, the carpet matches the wallpaper." He says, "It doesn't match the person."
Oh my goodness. That's hilarious. So
you know, they what comes out of their mouth, and that's worth something. It's really worth something for the kids. But no, but Barbara's been, you know, give her, she's the one that deserves the credit. She was there all the way. And she, good trooper too. You know, we're from California to New York to Greenwich to, you know, all over the place. And now, and we also have got together on real estate. I really, you know,
that's
one of the things
funny.
It's just, you know, in 1988, I'd sold the company. Mm-hmm. And so we decided together we'd take some of the money and buy places in someday that we might want to be.
There you go.
And so now at my ancient age now, we have a place in Florida and a place in Nantucket and live happily ever after.
How beautiful.
You know, I recommend to young people, if you want to live someplace, sometime in your life, there'll be a real estate cycle where you can buy in.
Yes, exactly. And you do. You just kind of wait for the cycle and keep on saving your money.
I came down here to Florida, and the guy said to me, If you put $5,000 down, you can buy that condominium. I said, what do you mean? He said, I get your mortgage. I'll rent the place for you.
Oh, no problem.
That was 1979. Real estate was in the tank. Nobody buy anything.
Yes.
Done.
Perfect.
You know, and we ended up with the place there, and we've now been here 40 years. So,
oh, my goodness. That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, that was the right time to do it. And
no, it was. It was exactly.
Perfect.
And it can happen again. But
yes.
If you went to the cabin in the woods, you'll find out those woods will vary in price over your lifetime. So
those are little
things that I think that, you know, if you live long enough, you can convey to people and not worry about it. You know,
exactly. And on your point of Barbara, by the way, I am, you know, you are right. I mean, we can really try to work on, you know, our marriages or our partnerships. And we always, you know, there are always things that come up. There are always little arguments. There are always disagreements. But I mean, things can be overcome, abuse or, you know, physical abuse or something.
Little tricks, Michelle.
Yes.
I'll give you two or three tricks. When you're first married, you take car trips every year.
Yes.
Get in the car for 3 or 4 days, you'll discuss everything.
Once you have
a family, you know, I always ask a question, nobody gets the right answers. What's the difference between a ski trip and a boat trip? At night, the kids disappear in a ski trip. At night on a boat trip, they can't disappear. They're there. You get a chance to chat with them. Also, we have a rule. We never go to bed angry at each other.
That's never.
Somebody takes the responsibility. You know,
never
go to bed angry. Those are little. And also, we do spend time alone, at least, you know, a regular basis. I talked to my daughter about it. She says we have date night once a month, and Barbara and I very rarely go away. Rarely a week when we don't spend an evening together. And also vacations. Vacations are so vital.
You know, when you
do things together, it's just great. So the marriage is that's what marriage is all about. But it's very funny. This boat trip is really funny because you get the kids on a boat. They're very different because they're stuck there. And at night they talk, you know.
There you go. That's exactly right.
But I gave a speech recently and I was talking about, I always say to Barbara, this is one of my standard lines, is I love her more than yesterday and less than tomorrow.
Well, there you go. Isn't there a song like that?
Isn't that wonderful? Then I say, every once in a while, we skip a couple of days.
There you go. Exactly. Oh, that's beautifully said. That's right. I love it. That's that song, I'll love you more today than yesterday, but not as much as tomorrow.
That's basically
what you're saying. Yeah,
she has it hanging around her neck now, so you always point at it.
Perfect. That's a little reminder. Point at it, you know, you go.
Remember what you said?
That's exactly. So let's get a little bit more into your strengths and your belief systems and how you can help our listeners out there. How would you define resilience? And what do you think are the characteristics or traits of resilient people?
Well, first of all, you have to be willing to try. It's very important to keep trying. And always, and early in life, you communicate to people is take experiences that make you a little bit uncomfortable. That's why I love traveling, because there's nothing more difficult than going to a place where you don't speak the language, you don't understand the food, and so forth. So put yourself in a relatively uncomfortable position, and if you can overcome that, even I said to my daughter when she went to San Francisco by herself, if you go by San Francisco, find an apartment, you know, find a job, overcome the city. That's a real accomplishment.
Yes.
Going to a foreign land or going on a raft trip or a Knowles trip, those are the kinds of things that build resilience because you're on your own.
Yes.
I sent all my kids to camp. No matter how you
always that's great.
Send them to camp. Now the little boys live in a tent. They make their bed every morning. They get up and they salute the flag. You know, that's key stuff. And you know, But resilience comes from that. And, of course, that's why I was privileged to have a rotten background because I gained resilience without knowing it. I had to do it. I had no choice.
Yeah.
I had no choice. But
beautiful.
I think that's it now is tell people that, you know, try things out. Always be out there adventuring. Go out and test yourself. And you know, I failed a lot. I mean, I said I wanted to be a physicist once, and when I was a sophomore, I took advanced physics instead of the regular physics course, and I flunked it. I D plus. I backed off and said, I don't want to be a physicist, you know.
There you go.
But being resilient, basically, it's a muscle. The more you use it and the more you test it, the stronger it'll be. I think that's really the answer. And it's not a simple answer.
Yes.
And you can't be testing all the time. You
have to,
but you have to so whatever you are, say, well, what's the answer here? How, where am I going to, you know, what do I have to find out?
Right.
And I, you know, I wanted to be an international businessman, so I took a job in Belgium between my 2 years at the business school and found out I loved Belgium. I loved international, but it wasn't for me.
You know,
in those days in 64, international business was extremely difficult because family-owned companies, language was, you know, language was you had to have really have the language well down. Today you don't. But anyway, so that's sort of resilience, Michelle. I mean, there's a lot of ways to describe it. There's, you know, but it really is trying things out and bouncing back. And always, and if you do something wrong, okay, it's a gift.
Right. See, and that's the optimism you're talking about in your book
Yeah.
You know, the self-confidence, I always ask people to define their personal strengths in order to, you know, build up their self-confidence and knowing about who they are. And like you said, the optimism, it's beautiful.
No, but self is the first job. It's really it's the first job. You gotta, and by the way, we're all different. So, you know, there's no right or wrong. You
have
to find your place in this. And there's so much availability to find your place that it's not that difficult. But you got to, the self is the most important thing, and it's self-confidence. And you gain self-confidence by going out and trying. You know?
Right, exactly. And I thought it was interesting also reading your book, On the Road Less Traveled. You mentioned several people who come to mind when you talk about resilience. Can you explain some of those people who you have mentioned and why?
You know, people, I mean, people that I respected.
Yes. Yes.
Well, you know, there is a, you know, there's real people, you know, and I use the Queen's Gambit because the little gal that is in that book is she's resilient and
she wins
the chess championship. But, you know, you look at Winston Churchill. Basically, never give up, you know, give up.
That's right.
You know, those are the people that, you know, and you look, there's a lot of businessmen in the same way, you know, although he died early and he was a little bit difficult to deal with. Steve Jobs was a very special man and he never gave up, you know, and they got fired and got thrown out and came back and, you know, really changed Apple.
Yeah.
You know, I use the fiction because in many respects, a lot of people, one woman described my book, she said, it reads like fiction, but it's real life.
Yes,
in many respects, fiction is something that gives you it allows you to take on real life with a, you know, a good taste in your mouth. This little gal in The Queen's Gambit was just fabulous. I mean, she kept going and going and going. But Winston Churchill, you know, there are people like Steve Jobs. People that really just, you know, that take on real adversity. And then there's people like, you know, I mean, there are so many people that have lived the American dream today, you know, that America has done such a wonderful thing for guys like me. I mean,
absolutely.
And it's so great. So those are some of the people that I sort of look to. And, you look at Eisenhower in the Second World War. I'm finally reading a lot about Second World War. You know, as an engineer, you don't get much of an education, but I spent the last 5 years now studying the Civil War and the Second World War, and it's just fascinating the kinds of
it
people,
is
what they did, you know, how they persevered, and so
it's
interesting. In today's world, you know, there's a lot of very very fine people that have, you know, done really wonderful things in the world and have changed the world, but it's not simple. Not simple.
Yes, exactly. It's every time I see my uncle, he's a 97-year-old World War II Navy, you know, veteran. I try to visit him as much as I can. He is sharp as a tack and just has so many wonderful stories about what he had to overcome during World War II. And these guys were just amazing, and women, they were amazing what they had to overcome and deal with.
Really tough, really. I spent 3 years in the Navy, but I was there, you know, I was only there at the beginning of the Vietnam War, and I was in the Western Pacific. Again, that's another thing we don't have, young people don't have anymore, is they had the shared experience of the service. I sat with a fellow who's about my age the other night for dinner. We talked about the service for 3 hours.
You know
from your 97-year-old, it was difficult.
Yes.
You know, it was hard, you know, there were a lot of horrible things, but it was a great experience. And you learn so much and the things you have to overcome. And once you overcome those things, you know, a lot of parts of life become a little bit easier.
It's so true. It's really true. I mean, again, that comparison that a lot of my listeners may have read your book or will have when they read your book, On the Road Less Traveled, and say, oh my gosh, I thought my life was tough. And this guy, look at who he is and what he's overcome to become the famous Ed Hajim. You know, I mean, come on now. This is, Hajim is an amazing fellow. So, I mean, you're inspiring people right now by talking about it. By the way, guys, in case you just tuned in, you're on the couch here with Dr. Michelle. And we're talking about Ed's book, On the Road Less Traveled. It's an unlikely journey from the orphanage to the boardroom. An amazing story. It's all true. And it's a wonderful read and most inspirational as well. I was wondering, you know, speaking about talking and learning and overcoming things, has there ever been a time that someone told you something that was impossible? It's like, you're never gonna achieve this, but you did it anyway.
Oh yeah, going to private college.
Oh,
in 1953, in an orphanage.
Yeah,
you know, working in a grocery store. You know, and looking at going to a private college. Most of the kids in the orphanage went to either no college or went to the local public college. I was going to go to a private college because I felt that was a ticket out of my situation. And I put my head down. I applied for every scholarship, and there weren't many in those days. And I was sure to get the New York State scholarship, and I didn't get it. And then I got the Naval scholarship. There were only 12 of them given out across the country, so I was very lucky. That was one thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, on the other hand, you know, I was at E.F. Hutton, and I was offered a job at Lehman Brothers, which was a very prestigious place, but supposedly had a lot of, you read about it in the book, it was a pretty terrible place. And everybody told me if you go there, you'll get torn up, it won't really work, and so forth. But the deal that the thing was so good that I couldn't turn it down, I went there. And they were right.
So
they told me it was impossible, and it was impossible because I did everything right. And after 7 years, the boss and I had a falling out, and I had to, I left. And people say to me, what's the hardest thing you ever did in your life? I said, I spent 7 years at Lehman Brothers literally doing everything that anyone could possibly do. I even impacted my own personal family life because, you know, it was a hard job.
Sure.
And I left after 7 years. No, it wasn't. It was financially okay, but,
but
I left after basically failing. So,
was,
they told me it was impossible, and they were right.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
Oh, no, I'll tell you, most things you do, my humor magazine was impossible.
Sure.
Starting at the golf course, which I started in Nantucket, they said, nobody's going to be able to do that. Then, you know, Rochester, we decided to raise $1 billion. They said, we've never raised $1 billion. You can't do that. And, you know, I think one of the things that excites people is to do something that can't be done, you know.
Well, right. And, you know, as you mentioned in your book, not having control over your life as a child, you know, really produced a strong drive to seek freedom as an adult. And I find that all the time with people who I talk to in my practice. And that, you know, foundation also, which gave you the ability to recognize your need, you know, to balance, like
you want freedom, you work for smaller companies, and you also, you know, be a place where you have control over what's going on.
There you go. That's exactly
right.
You got
to be responsible. You know, you've got this responsibility too.
You really do. And it, of course, you really did that perfectly well, by the way. So.
But that was a very good question. Have you ever done something? Because most of your life, people look back at things that they've accomplished. In many cases, they're mostly nice naysayers. Very few times do you do anything really good that people think is easy.
That's exactly right. They do. And it's not that you're, you know, professing that everything's a struggle, life's a struggle. It's like you embrace it. You have this, you know, sort of personality that says, bring it. Bring it, and I'll do what I can do with it. Bring it on, you know.
Bring it on. Bring it on. Exactly right.
Yeah, that's why you're such a person.
And surround yourself with the right people, and you're home free.
Oh, you said it. You said it. So right now, if you could inspire a movement that would bring the most amount of good to the most amount of people, what would that be?
I have a mini crusade, which I can pass on to people.
Okay.
It's vocational education.
Uh-huh.
At the club in Nantucket, we're giving out 7 scholarships. I think that, you know, jobs are still the most important thing. And the problem we have now is we're not training the people to do things they want to do.
Yes.
But I want to change the name of vocational education to technical education or something else. And I want to really, you know, I want to, and I'm behind Biden's, you know, making the community college as cheap as possible.
Yes.
I think vocational education, I think, will bring the most good, and I think the most, I guess it will bring the most joy to people at this point. Give them something that they really want to do. You want to be a car mechanic, don't put you in a class studying, you know, 14th century Western European history. I mean, it's not intelligent. So, vocational education is my mini cry now for doing the most. And I've got I'm doing a little bit of work on that right now. And by the way, it's not cheap. I mean, to go to a good school to become a chef costs tuition's $40,000. So it's not easy. But that would be the one that I would do. And of course, I do believe the second right behind that is medical science. So what we're doing now, besides COVID, I mean, at my age now, I have 7 people with Alzheimer's.
Friends, oh, my
very
goodness.
Close friends.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And it is it is so bad. I mean,
yes,
so
it is.
I'd say the most good, you know, will come out of that. It's a little less practical than vocational education, but I'm really feel that that's one of the things that has to, the neurological diseases have to be coped with, you know.
Right.
I hope that something comes out of COVID too, but that's right. That's the next thing is nothing's worse than seeing someone's wife who doesn't recognize him. I mean,
My God, it's so true. Or parents or whatever. It's just so difficult and sad. And, you know, you only hope that they're not in pain and they're not suffering.
And the numbers are overwhelming. I mean, if we don't
cure this thing,
in the next 15 or 20 years, you're just getting more and more people. And so it's not something. And I think we'll cure it. I think they're on their way. I've seen some studies. That,
yes, they are.
We've cured a lot of things. We'll cure this, too. But that'll make a big change.
Yes. And I agree. And there is a lot of work going on in the laboratories right now in order to, and they are using test subjects. And so it's positive.
Yeah, so I can do something about vocational education. I can do very little about curing Alzheimer's.
No, that's for sure. Vocational education is beautiful too, because, you know, again, there's not that force involved. It's allowing people to explore their passions or their gifts, you know, as you talked about earlier.
Yeah, it's harder to get my computer guy to come over to my house than it is to see the doctor.
No kidding. I hear you.
my plumber makes as much money as my doctor, you know, so.
Oh, that's for sure. that's absolutely.
And by the way, he probably gets more satisfaction when he gets something done than the doctor does.
Well said, Ed.
I just think that people should figure out what they really want to do. That's a self thing, you know, and do it. And, you know, you'll find out that you'll be much happier doing that and, you know, and getting that done. And there are things you can learn today, you know, on almost every field that are just very unique and satisfying and so forth. So
that's so true. Well, our time's just about up here, Ed, already. It went so fast.
Oh, God, it goes so quickly.
I know, it does.
I have to get away. I have to get up off the couch.
You can stay. It's fine with me.
this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome, Ed. And by the way, listeners, you can pick up Ed Hagem's amazing book on Amazon, of course. And you can find out more about Ed.
And by the way, it's Audible too. You can listen to it if you're a slow reader like me.
No, you know, and there's those people who like audio more than reading anyway. It's just,
I do too. I do.
Me too. And you can pick up his book also on his website, www.ed. It's actually pronounced Hagem.
Hagem, like shouting for Jim,
That's it. It's spelled EDHAJIM.com. And it's On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. Beautiful book. And thank you for blessing us with that today, Ed.
No, thank you very much. Been a joy.
Right. Thank you. And
thank
take
you.
Care.
Have a great day.
I will. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
All right, guys. Hey, listen, thank you so much for being here with me on the couch. This is Dr. Michelle Cohen. And as I always say, do take care of yourself first. And then you'll be great for others. And thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next Tuesday at 12 noon. And we're going to have Sharon Prentice on, who is an amazing woman. And she's going to tell us about her shared out-of-body experience and all of the things she learned about how to live a better life. Bye-bye, guys.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.